Hallo liebe Dissens-Fans, hier ist Inken vom Was tun Podcast und heute gibt es mal wieder eine Folge von uns auf die Ohren. Wir haben mit dem US-amerikanischen Politikwissenschaftler David Karpf über Big Tech und Politik gesprochen, über Donald Trump und Elon Musk und über Lehren aus den US-Wahlen für die Bundestagswahl. Und jetzt viel Spaß bei unserer Folge.
It has always stood out to me that the playing field between progressives and right-wing authoritarians is unbalanced. It's a slanted playing field. And the reason it's slanted is the basic story that is told by right-wing populists is that the reason your life isn't the way you want it to be is that politics is very simple, but government and governance are run by crooks and idiots. And if you elect me, I will fire the crooks and idiots, and then everything will be better. And from a messaging standpoint, that's a very compelling story. Right? Like, you can write, like, that is all the components of a story. It's got a hero, a victim, a villain, a plot resolution. And there are crooks and idiots in government. So the idea that everything would just be better if we got rid of them is so appealing. And the message of progressives, even though we also can have populists saying, like, the billionaire class is crooks and idiots, and if we tax them, things will get better. Like, we have some variants of that that can be popular. But the basic message is government and governance is actually complex. Democracy can make things better, but it takes a lot of work and it's at the margins and we have to keep on building it over time, right? Like, democracy is fragile, it requires constant maintenance. And that has the benefit of being true and the downside of being a terrible, uninspiring story. The thing that I'm really liking right now is all the people talking about how Elon Musk is the reason why Donald Trump got elected and is basically co-president. I can tell you as a scholar, that's not true. As an academic, that is not true. As an activist, that is useful. Because the moment that Donald Trump decides that Elon Musk is outshining him is the moment that Elon Musk starts to get shut out. And Elon Musk does too much ketamine and has ego control issues and impulse control issues. So the moment he starts getting shut out by Donald Trump is the moment they all spiral out of control and that fractures. If what we want is fractures, I think right now is a great idea to talk about co-president Elon Musk, who's the real power behind the throne.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Was tun Podcast. Hier sprechen wir einmal im Monat mit Linken, Intellektuellen und Aktivisten darüber, wie wir als Linke nicht nur kämpfen, sondern auch gewinnen können. Wir, das sind Inken Beermann und Valentin Eason, wir diskutieren viel über politische Strategie und machen diesen Podcast, um die Diskussion darüber mit euch zu teilen. Ja, wir sind mitten in der Vorweihnachtszeit gelandet und normalerweise merkt man ja schon so gegen Ende des Jahres, dass es so ein bisschen ruhiger wird um die Politik. Alle sich jetzt schon so ein bisschen einstellen, vielleicht innerlich auf die Zeit zwischen den Jahren, wo man aus der Politik eigentlich fast nichts mehr hört und alles so ein bisschen pausiert scheint. In diesem Jahr ist es allerdings ganz schön anders und das hat vor allem zwei Gründe.
Ja, da ist einmal die Amtseinführung von Donald Trump am 20. Januar, die auf uns wartet und auf die viele Menschen in Deutschland, natürlich insbesondere in den USA, aber ich glaube auch weltweit mit Spannung blicken, was dann eigentlich alles an Tag 1 passieren wird. Und dann natürlich Ende Februar die Bundestagswahl in Deutschland, wo wir hier besonders merken, dass wir uns eigentlich schon mit einem Wahlkampf befinden. Die Kombination aus diesen beiden großen politischen Ereignissen jetzt um die Weihnachtszeit bzw. Anfang des neuen Jahres haben wir jetzt als Anlass genommen, um mit einem Experten für politische Kampagnen und Social Media Campaigning zu sprechen. David Karpf forscht seit 20 Jahren zu Kampagnenorganisationen, Petitionen, Online-Aktionen im Netz und dazu, wie Technologie und vor allem digitale Technologie mit Politik zusammenhängen. Und wir haben jetzt mit ihm darüber gesprochen, was wir vielleicht sogar auch in Deutschland für Lehren aus dem US-Wahlkampf ziehen können, wie schlimm es mit Donald Trump wird und wie sich Social Media in den letzten 20 Jahren von eigentlich einem Ort des demokratischen Diskurses hin zur Monopolplattform von Tech-Milliardären verwandelt hat.
Viel Spaß bei der Folge.
Viel Spaß.
Hello, David. Great to have you on our podcast.
Great to be here.
Hi.
David, you are one of the most interesting commentators on tech and politics. And we want to talk a lot about these topics. But before we dive into that, let's talk a little bit about Trump and the elections. You live with your family in Washington, D.C., and we are recording this interview only a few weeks before the second Trump inauguration takes place in Washington, D.C. How is the atmosphere right now, and how are you feeling personally today?
One difference between this Trump term and the last one is when Trump was elected the first time, there was this sense of shock. Like, everyone knew mathematically it could happen, but nobody really believed he could be elected back in 2016. And that shock then turned to outrage, where by January, we were mass mobilizing, saying, this is not us. This was a mistake. We are going to prevent this. And this time, everyone knew that he could win, not just because the polls showed that he could win, but also because he had won before. So clearly he can't, it can happen. But it's not just that we had the 4 years of experience of what was Trump like. We also had January 6th. We also had the ongoing lawsuits against him, including one that he was found guilty of, 34 felonies. We've never had a felon running for president before. So there was a sense that in this election, where in 2016, nobody really believed it. This time, everyone knew it could happen. And the majority of the voting electorate chose him anyway. And so I'd say the mood is more tilted towards despair than outrage. You know that Trump 2 is going to be worse for progressive issues and for the populace than Trump 1 was. And Trump 1 was real bad. We know that on day one, he's announced this, on day one, he's going to let out of jail all of the January 6th rioters. You know, they're going to be back on the streets. And, you know, that's unsurprising. He did say in the campaign that he was going to do that. And they are in jail for being his most vociferous supporters. Like, they assaulted the Capitol because he wanted them to. So now he's letting them out. But that makes this very dangerous times where we're unsure how many of the elements of civil society that we're used to will still be there. There's reporting that during the first Trump administration, he wanted the military to shoot protesters, and his generals told him no. He will have different generals this time. And he's been very clear that he wants generals who will follow a loyalty test and do whatever he wants them to do. So I'd say for people working in politics right now, it's a mix of denial and despair. And I'm not sure which is better, right? The despair is, my God, he has unfettered power. The Supreme Court is behind him. He has the legislature. We have no good ideas. And this is the most dangerous scenario we've seen since at least the American Civil War. And the people in denial are saying, you know what? We fought him last time. We're able to turn back so much we wanted to do. We can use that playbook. We can do it again now. I don't think that's true. I'm pretty sure Trump 2 will be significantly worse than Trump 1. And I can sort of lay out all the reasons why. I've done so in blog posts. But also, despair isn't helpful. So the people in denial are probably more productive right now.
Maybe let's stick a little bit with what will happen under the second Trump term. What do you think? We have seen a lot of reporting on how Ramaswamy and Elon Musk will try to cut back on regulations and all of this kind of stuff. We have also read a little bit about the Trump 2025 project. What do you think will they prioritize on their list, and what will be the effects on progressive politics?
But it sounds like the plan is to make a list of all the regulatory agencies that they themselves don't like, and all the regulations that get in their way, for instance, any regulation having anything to do with cryptocurrency, and just announce, we're going to say all this is illegal. My hunch is what that means is the set of regulatory agencies that have pissed Elon Musk off over the past several years. And that's the Securities and Exchange Commission, the company that says you're not allowed to do fraud. The Federal Trade Commission, which also says to companies, you're not allowed to do fraud. Pretty much every agency that says you can't do fraud. Also, the Environmental Protection Agency that says, Tesla, you can't just dump your toxins in the drinking water. The National Highway Safety and Transportation Association, which says, hey, your self-driving cars need to not crash. All of those agencies are probably going to get decimated. And that's not actually going to save people money, but what it's going to do is allow rampant fraud and corruption from the large companies and investment projects of the multi-billionaire class. And good luck suing against that, because Trump already has, I think, about a fifth of the judiciary. He'll have two-fifths or more within the next 4 years. So what we should be expecting is even the laws that are on the books, even if they can't change them through Congress because they'd be unpopular, they will just stop enforcing them and they'll gut every agency that enforces them.
I think that's really interesting. And also in contrast to other people that we talked about from countries where there was a significant right shift, that in the US right now, where in other places, courts were the kind of place where still laws would be held up. Now in the US, courts are actually the place where the shift is maybe at the moment most significant to the right and will kind of persist longest to the right, which makes it really difficult in your situation. When we maybe look at the place more of like what people can actually do, how do you think like the resistance might be different this time, or where might be chances of resistance against this Trump government?
So it's hard to say. And the other thing that we don't yet know about what Trump 2 will be like. Okay, I think we need to take seriously his ambitions. He has said that he wants to deport like 10 to 20 million people from this country. And logistically, that is impossible to do smoothly. Mm-hmm. Like if deporting those numbers, because he says they're all illegal immigrants or undocumented Americans, to round up those numbers, you're rounding up a lot of people who are citizens as well, but just have the wrong color skin or have pissed off the wrong official until they decide we're going to send you out anyway. And of course, then where are they going to send them? They can't send them back to home countries, many of whom have never lived there. So we would be talking about the construction of camps and storing people at camps. That is his ambition, and we should take his ambition seriously. We should also take seriously that the people who he is appointing to this stuff are managerially incompetent, is my sophisticated way of saying fucking idiots. Like there's some of the intellectuals who are probably going to be in the Trump administration. I have tangled, they're political scientists. I've tangled with them in the past. And like, I've been to their panels at the academic meetings. They are full of the dumbest, least insightful people in my profession. They are not people who can manage large scale things. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest benefits during the first Trump administration was that his ambitions were counterbalanced by his own incompetence. So we won't know until not even January, it's probably February, March, April 2025 is when we will start to get a sense of, is the second Trump administration full fascism, where they implement their plans, crack down on all civil resistance, deport 10 to 20 million Americans, and, you know, outlaw the free press effectively, right? Like that's the worst case scenario. And that is, a lot of that is in Project 2025. Or do they talk about a bunch of that? But then, you know, like during the first Trump administration, he kept talking about how he was going to build a wall with Mexico. And then he built a tiny section of wall, because building a wall is actually managerially very hard, and the guy didn't have the stamina for it. So we could end up in a world where he talks like a fascist and implements like somebody who needs a nap every 15 minutes. And if we're in that second world, then the threats will be objectively less bad. And the way that you confront them is mostly by exacerbating the internal tensions, right? Like all of the people working for him leaked like a sieve to the press, what, 4 or 8 years ago? Because mm-hmm. they were constantly trying to fight it out with each other. Mm-hmm. And this time, since he can't run for re-election, and I know he keeps on saying, yeah, mm-hmm. maybe I'll do a third term, but the man is too old for it. Like he's not going to, even if he overthrows the Constitution, he's not going to do another term. And he has no successor. Like J.D. Vance is not the actual successor. So every one of his lieutenants is going to be jockeying for position and trying to have a sort of rhetorical knife fight with the other people in the administration. That internal chaos, there will be a window for activists in resistance to try to fan the flames of that chaos and sort of encourage journalists to help fan it as well. That could help slow them down if we're in that second world. Mm-hmm. If we're in the first world where it's full fascism, then I want to emphasize how little I know about how that will go, because my whole career has been spent studying primarily reformist civil society organizations in the United States, with a little bit of studying similar organizations in other advanced democracies, right? Like mm-hmm. I'm thinking this particular week when we're talking, just last week, there was a coup attempt the declaration mm-hmm. of martial law in South Korea. And people took to the streets, and the legislators immediately said, no, we don't do that here. We lived under authoritarianism in what I think was the 1980s. We're not going back. And so they shut that down at three in the morning the night it happened. That was based on an activist repertoire forged under authoritarianism that was still memorable for their country. You don't have that tactical repertoire in the United States. The tactics that I was raised on and that I've studied throughout my life assume a functional civil society that, while the rule of law is never perfect, at least always gestures towards the rule of law, and you can lean on those gestures. I mean, the tactics that I used the most growing up were petitions. You're not going to petition under fascism because you're just offering them a list of names of the opposition for them to round up. I don't know if we'll be in a situation that dangerous, because I'm not sure that he and his team will be nearly that confident, but they've made clear that those are their ambitions. So for the next few months, all I can really say is a sort of bold-faced, I do not know, where we have to wait and figure out what world we're living in.
And you talked a little bit about like escalating the fight of the egos in the Trump administration. Do you see any particular strategic ways for progressive activists to escalate this?
So the details are wait and see. We don't know yet. The one thing that stands out, my research, as an aside, my research for the past few years has been on what I call the history of the digital future. I've been reading old tech magazines to get a sense of what they thought the future would be, what went wrong, and how we got to now, which is separate from the activism research that I've long done. But that stands out because of that research. A thing that usually bugs me is when people overinflate the effectiveness of Elon Musk. Like, people talk about him as this like Tony Stark, Iron Man, tech genius who can fix any company. And then you look at the actual guy and it's like, no, he's very, very rich. He got a couple lucky breaks. There's a few management things that he does pretty well. But like, the man is not a world historic genius. Like, look at how he ran Twitter into the ground. Like, this man is not magic. So I am usually very annoyed when people talk about Elon Musk as though he's a god king. But a thing that I'm really liking right now is all the people talking about how Elon Musk is the reason why Donald Trump got elected and is basically co-president. I can tell you as a scholar, that's not true. As an activist, that is useful. Because the moment that Donald Trump decides that Elon Musk is outshining him is the moment that Elon Musk starts to get shut out. And Elon Musk does too much ketamine and has ego control issues and impulse control issues. So the moment he starts getting shut out by Donald Trump is the moment they all spiral out of control, and that fractures. If what we want is fractures, I think right now is a great idea to talk about co-president Elon Musk, who's the real power behind the throne. So that kind of thing is probably what we want to be doing, at least in our media rhetoric. But again, that's going to work a lot better in the version of the Trump administration where nothing is going well and then everyone is blaming each other for their failures, than in the version where they just, like, if they just gut all the agencies and then shut down the media, then us saying on, you know, Blue Sky, like, haha, look at co-president Elon Musk, isn't going to leave the same mark. Because they'll have a ministry of information that's shutting all that down. Like things could get serious enough that tactic ends up looking paltry by comparison. But that's the one sort of angle that I've noticed so far.
Hi, du hörst den Was tun Podcast. Und wir produzieren diesen Podcast einmal im Monat werbefrei und unabhängig. Das können wir machen, weil so viele von euch uns schon unterstützen. Und zwar mit einer Doppelmitgliedschaft im Was tun Podcast und Dissens Podcast. Wie ihr dabei sein könnt, ganz einfach, klickt einfach auf den Link in den Shownotes. Schon ab 2 Monaten könnt ihr uns im Abo monatlich unterstützen und dazu beitragen, dass wir auch weiterhin diesen Podcast produzieren und ihr jeden Monat eine neue Folge mit interessanten, linken Intellektuellen und Aktivistinnen auf die Ohren bekommt. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim Weiterhören.
If we now take a step back again and look a little bit at the elections, there have been multiple and various ways of explaining the Democratic defeat. How have you perceived the different arguments around this victory of Donald Trump and the defeat of Kamala Harris? And especially as someone who in the past has also been quite enthusiastic about the Harris campaign in general.
What stands out to me, it was about like a 5 or 6% shift nationwide in Trump's direction, which still ends up being a close election overall, but is a larger shift than the polls saw coming or most people saw coming. In a shift of that scale, like, the one intellectual benefit of that, like, only an intellectual benefit, not a benefit for the lives we lead. But 2016 was so close that you could look to any one factor and say, well, that's a tiny factor, but it's enough to make up the difference. Mm-hmm. So we can place the blame on this thing. This is a large enough shift that you can't really blame any of the factors that we would naturally point to. Like, there was worry when Harris became the nominee that there are too many racists and sexists in the United States to elect a woman of color. Like, I do think that there's probably some penalty for female candidates running for president and for people of color running for president. That is part of the United States history, and that's part of our electorate now. If she had lost by, 50,000 votes nationwide, then I could imagine soul-searching around, oh, if only we had a different candidate. But a shift of that magnitude means, no, there's not some other candidate that would have won. That also, a shift of that magnitude means, her media strategy, people were debating before the election, should she go on the Joe Rogan podcast? If it had been a much smaller loss, then I could imagine people really obsessing over that, saying that would have made the difference. But any one tactic, a thing that we say amongst scholars who study U.S. elections is that campaigns only matter at the margins. Like, the best one campaign can deliver you some more votes that will turn a tiny, tiny loss into a tiny, tiny victory. But campaign effects are maybe a couple percentage points. They are not 10, 20, 30%. The people who before the election were saying, look at Donald Trump, Kamala Harris should be winning in a blowout. That was a clever thing to say that never had any real basis in reality. You don't win blowouts in presidential elections in present day America. It doesn't happen because, again, of sort of the state of the electorate. People are sorted by partisanship. There's nothing that a Republican is going to say that's going to get me to vote for Republican. There's nothing that a Democrat is going to say that is going to get most Republican voters to vote for Democrats. The lines are just pretty well set. With all that said, the disappointing thing that I come down on, we knew before Election Day that 2024 was turning out to be a very tough year across the world for incumbent parties. That whether it's inflation or sort of aftershock of COVID, when people in large-scale democracies are voting, they are voting incumbents out of office, whether those incumbents are liberal or conservative. I had hoped before the election that since Donald Trump was the person who was running the government during COVID, and since our economic recovery has been better than other countries' economic recoveries, I had hoped that we would be the exception to that rule. Looking at the election results, again, like, these were candidates that everyone knew in advance. It's not like Donald Trump was offering radical change or some new beginning. He was offering a return to what he did last time with more viciousness and more cognitive impairment, right? Like, he is a little far gone from where he was in 2016 if you listen to his speeches. And yet people looked at that and said, I do not like the status quo. Things are bad. I would like things to be different. I'm going to vote for the party that offers different. And so they did go back to him. But what I think happened is, people were very excited about Biden when it felt like a new beginning and an end to the pandemic era. The vaccine was coming out. It was all exciting. And then it turned out that the reality that we live in is still just disappointing. And we're still just amidst all of these challenges that government can't fix because it's just too complicated. Like, government can't repair the psychic damage of COVID. Nothing can. And once that reality set in, people said the point of Biden was we could return to normalcy. This isn't normal. I don't like it. And they've been upset ever since. And then we had inflation for a couple of years, and inflation was bad, even though people's wages were rising faster than inflation. But people didn't like seeing that, and they were kind of mad about that too, even though economists kept saying that we thought there would be a recession. There's no recession. This is incredible. People didn't care about that. And so people were ready to vote the incumbent party out of office. That's ultimately very frustrating for campaigners and for people who study campaigners. That's a story that says, ultimately, I think the Kamala Harris campaign ran about as good of a campaign as they could have. Mm-hmm. The campaign that I was watching was about as bad of a campaign as he could run. Like, he entrusted his field turnout mechanism to Elon Musk, who had never done it before and wasn't doing a good job. Like, he was making rookie mistakes. None of that. And we see that in the election results, where in the swing states where they did the most campaigning, Harris lost about 3% on average instead of 6% nationwide. Campaigning was beneficial where they did it. She clearly had a better campaign than her opponent. But that didn't matter against this sort of tidal swing of people wanting to oppose parties in office because they don't like the status quo right now.
And what do you think of these explanations, like people saying that Kamala Harris let down the working classes, or that the democracy framing was way too abstract and way too far away from people's lived realities, or some people even saying that Democrats have been campaigning too woke to win? And some of these explanations are completely contradictory, but I've heard all of them, and I would be interested in hearing your opinion, especially on the working class and Bernie would have won take.
The reason why, like, Bernie supporters are making that argument is really because they want to shape the party going forward, right? So they're saying this language would have worked more. it wouldn't have worked more. Like, messaging, and I say this as somebody who is a tenured professor who teaches messaging. I will be teaching a class on strategic political communication about 3 hours from now. So, like, this is what I teach and what I study. So it pains me to say this, but the impact of your messages and frames only matters at the tiny margins. It is not large enough to impact the outcome of this election. So the people who are saying, oh, she lost because the Democratic Party is too woke, they don't really believe that if they had used different messages that she would have won. What they believe is they would like their segment of the party coalition to have more power going forward, please. Mm-hmm. And the Bernie supporters who say Bernie would have won, like, no, Bernie would not have won. But they would like the party network to move more towards the working class and those messages moving forward. So I can understand why they're saying the things that they're saying. And the way to frame those things right now is to talk retrospectively about the election and kind of pretend if in a different world, things would have been different. But no, different message. Like, she didn't run a woke campaign. Like, she really didn't. She also didn't run a particularly working class or anti-working class campaign. Like, maybe if we could go back three years and have Biden not run, like, maybe things are a little different. I kind of doubt it. Really, if I had a magic wand and I could change one thing that I think would make a difference, our Attorney General Merrick Garland slow walked the cases against Donald Trump. Donald Trump should not have been able to run for election because he committed treason on January 6th. There was a court case over that has now been set aside because they waited too long and he won. And part of why they waited too long is the Supreme Court, which had a majority of Trump supporters, weighed in and said, we're going to pause this and slow it down however we can. But if I could go back to 2021 and force Merrick Garland to just move faster, then like that would have made a difference. But if Trump is the nominee, I think we're still facing Trumpism now. Again, because there's no messaging choices that can get you around the global trend that's happening that I think is really about COVID and post-COVID inflation. Like that trend we're seeing worldwide, that's affecting parties, whether the incumbent party is conservative or liberal, whether it is populist or centrist. So I just think it's kind of unserious to say, oh, like if we had had the messaging of Bernie Sanders, then this election would have been in the bag. Like, no. Mm-hmm. That said, I would like the Democratic Party not to abandon its party coalition. And I think the working class policies are good policies. So I'd like that part of the party coalition to win some more internal power. But it feels unserious because, again, Donald Trump may, within the next 6 months, be building camps to store millions of people in. If that's happening and we're still fighting over messaging, then we are really kidding ourselves.
I can definitely relate to that. I definitely get the part of this was a change election. People just wanted change and like things to be normal and different again. Do you still think, or still in the light of this experience, is there anything that we still can learn? Because right now it feels to me a little bit like if the general trend is in this way, then we actually can't do anything. Why are we doing like an election campaign anyway? And I feel like a little bit like this also in respect to Germany, because we are looking towards federal elections now in Germany too in February. And I think there's something fairly similar going on with a lot of people just wishing for change and feeling that inflation has cost them too much. Although same thing, it could have been a lot worse and everything. Yeah, I just wonder if we see the general trend that clearly, is there anything that we can do in campaigns? Do you think there's anything that we can learn maybe?
So I have a couple of thoughts, neither of which are a direct answer. One is I would offer a sort of a note of hope that if we go back to 2016, there was Brexit, there was Trump, there was this sense that right-wing authoritarians and populist movements were winning everywhere. And one thing that happened after Brexit and Trump is it did seem like other countries said, oh, this is serious, take this seriously. And like, let's knock it off with the authoritarians. Right. Like Meloni won in Italy. A lot of right wing authoritarians have been winning in various countries. So I think people should take this seriously and be worried. It's also possible that the rest of the world looking at the United States saying, my God, they just elected Donald Trump again, like that guy, because he has a global reputation and it's not a good one. Like that could be a bit of a wake up call. That could be a splash of cold water in the faces of people who say, yeah, maybe we've gone too far with this stuff and we should settle down. I think that's a message worth testing. I don't know if that message is going to work. Mm-hmm. But if I was running a party or an advocacy nonprofit, I would run some A/B tests or some focus groups to figure out whether that message is resonating post-Trump in a way it didn't before. Beyond that, the thing that always sticks out to me, this is part of the lecture that I'm going to give my students in 3 hours, like it has always stood out to me that the playing field between progressives and right-wing authoritarians is unbalanced. It's a slanted playing field. And the reason it's slanted is the story, the basic story that is told by right-wing populists is that the reason your life isn't the way you want it to be is that politics is very simple, but government and governance are run by crooks and idiots. And if you elect me, I will fire the crooks and idiots, and then everything will be better. And from a messaging standpoint, that's a very compelling story, right? Like, you can write, like, that is all the components of a story. It's got a hero, a victim, a villain, a plot resolution. And there are crooks and idiots in government. So the idea that everything would just be better if we got rid of them is so appealing. And the message of progressives, even though we also can have populists saying, like, the billionaire class is crooks and idiots, and if we tax them, things get better. Like, we have some variants of that that can be popular. But the basic message is government and governance is actually complex. Democracy can make things better, but it takes a lot of work and it's at the margins and we have to keep on building it over time, right? Like, democracy is fragile. It requires constant maintenance. And that has the benefit of being true and the downside of being a terrible, uninspiring story. Like, the fundamental reality of a complex government and government is one that is hard to defend because it's just so much easier. Like, I think about this because I'm an old environmental activist. Like, I think about this around climate. The right-wing populists are saying climate change isn't real. The entire scientific establishment is just trying to lie to you to make communism happen. Elect me and you don't need to worry about it anymore. That is completely false. And also, the more I look at the climate crisis, the more appealing that story seems. Because we don't have any good, simple solutions besides a time machine for dealing with the climate crisis. Things have gotten bad and we know they will get worse. And it will take so many things just to mitigate the things making it worse. My God, in a world where actually that's all made up by corrupt bureaucrats that we can kick out and they'll be fine. Like, that is a much simpler story that lets you sleep better at night if you were to believe it. The problem is that it's a lie. So I think that the campaigners should be aware of that challenge, that we are standing on a slanted playing field trying to defend complex systems that often disappoint us. And then we need to go back to basics and connect with our fellow citizens, connect with our neighbors, build the types of robust institutions that support the vulnerable, and build power that we can then use to make collective demands while also showing grace to one another. And that's the basics. That's organizing principles that are in books that I teach from the 1970s and that I started studying in the 1990s. There's nothing sort of radical, digital, or new there. But those fundamentals, because it's complex and we always need to keep on maintaining it, like, we still need that stuff and we should go back to those basics because it's kind of all we have right now in a changing world.
If we nonetheless stick with technology a second, the US elections are often also like testing grounds for new trends in election campaigning and new ways of involving social media in election messaging. Was there anything new that you've seen in the way these platforms have been used for political messaging? And is there maybe also something that we will, that we may also see in the German elections, which are coming up?
Sure. And I feel like the two notes on social media that matter. The first is that the large platforms that defined electoral campaigning in the United States for the past decade or so are all falling apart. The most obvious one is Twitter, now X, which has seen a mass exodus since the election, but was falling apart before the election. Like, it's still mostly, it's now mostly Republicans on there, which means that it is losing the sort of central place that it used to have. X mattered less to the mass electorate this time than it did 4 years ago or 8 years ago. And meanwhile, Facebook/Instagram/Threads is, they decided to de-emphasize politics and for years now have also de-emphasized news. So, like, if we went back to 2014, the reason why Facebook was so important to elections is that Facebook was critical to news organizations because like 70% of views to news articles were coming through Facebook. That has fallen off a cliff because they've adjusted their algorithms to try to give people other stuff. And so Facebook has mattered less to information gathering as well. That's left us with sort of a fractured social media landscape where everybody was trying things and they're still fundamentally just trying to reach audiences where they are. But what that meant was sort of a bunch of stuff that we kind of could have guessed in advance. Like, if you're trying to reach young people, you go on TikTok. If you're trying to reach old people, then you still use Facebook because old people use Facebook. Also, if you're trying to reach individual niche audiences, you go on podcasts because the large podcasts have niche audiences that are built in for them. But you're still just trying to present a message to people where they are and where they'll encounter it. And that used to be like two or three big platforms, and now it's fractured. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is Elon Musk, like we knew he was a conservative coming into this, but we thought 2 years ago, I think people figured he's a conservative, but also he's a businessman. And so he's not going to want to completely turn Twitter into a propaganda network for one party, because then he has to worry about both the other party leaving that network. And also if they maintain power, not doing business with them anymore. Elon Musk went all the way full propagandist and turned Twitter, now X, into just a right-wing propaganda network. And I would expect he's going to be doing that globally as well. Like, he has more at stake in the United States than in other countries, because it's where his companies are based and where he's based. Like, the election of Donald Trump means that a bunch of investigations into Elon Musk and his companies will now end. But he has also made it real clear that when a right-wing authoritarian government wants X to reveal information about activists that offend them, X hands it over. And when a left-wing government wants information on activists that tried to commit a coup, he stonewalls them. So he has made it very clear that that network is for right-wing propaganda and electing authoritarians. Activists going into it should just be aware that that's what they're going to get from that network. It's becoming more of a propaganda network while also declining in influence because people are fleeing the site.
Hallo und sorry für die kurze Unterbrechung. Du hörst den Was-Tun-Podcast und heute sprechen wir mit dem Politikwissenschaftler und Aktivisten David Karpf über die US-Wahl, über die politische Situation auch in Deutschland jetzt vor der Bundestagswahl und darüber, wie Big-Tech-Milliardäre Social Media verändert haben und damit auch den Raum für unsere politischen Aktionen. Wenn du jetzt schon an Freundinnen oder Verwandte gedacht hast, die diese Folge auch interessieren würde, dann zöger jetzt nicht länger, sondern klick in deinem Podcatcher auf den Teilen-Button und schick ihnen die Folge. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim Weiterhören.
In the early 2000s, you have started studying politics online. And I think you were also among the people who were pretty enthusiastic about the potential, the political potential behind these technologies. And now, 20 years forward, we are in this different world where the utopian beginnings of social media have withered away. And now it all seems quite dystopian. And even like if we look at what the Silicon Valley signifies in the political discourse, it has moved from being like a place of liberalism somehow to, we remember the Arab Spring Revolution, for example, where Facebook has really been an important place for organizing, to the present where Elon Musk is in a coalition with fascism. How have we got there? What happened? Why are we here?
Well, so first of all, I should say, invite me back on the podcast in early 2026, because I'll have a whole book on that exact topic coming out from Norton in 2026. Working title is Why the Future Never Arrives. But yeah, so that's essentially the big puzzle that I've been studying for years now. And the way you narrated that kind of makes clear how I got to this project. I was never a tech utopian. The thing I was always doing was studying on the ground how organizations making use of this. And what I was noticing was, there's a bunch of potential. I think the broad lesson, this lesson was clear in 2017 already, is that democracy is fragile and disruptive technologies aren't inherently good for fragile things. I think we took for granted that democracy would be stable and would be rising and that people would like it. And we also took for granted that if we trust the messages of Silicon Valley technologists and we don't regulate them, we don't tax them, we let them accrue all the power, that they would use that power in ways that would improve society and lift all boats. And instead, what happened was a small number of companies and a small number of individuals got far too much power and then got upset when people started holding them accountable for the world as it is, rather than judging them based solely on their ambitions. Or like underneath every tech billionaire is a young startup dude with grand ambitions for how they're going to change the world. And when they're a young startup dude in the 1990s, whether that is Marc Andreessen or Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, they are being judged based on their ambitions, the world they want to create. And then in the 20-teens through today, when they are running sometimes trillion-dollar companies, they are being judged based on their impacts and their behavior rather than their ambitions. And that's less fun. And if you are a multi-billionaire who is used to being told that you are a god king, and suddenly you're being called before Congress to explain why does your platform make so much money off of misinformation, or why has it cannibalized journalism? You know, why is hate speech running amok there? That's a bummer. And you're a multi-billionaire. You're not supposed to face bummers. So I mean, the short version of how we got here is we let too much power concentrate amongst a few people who kept promising that they'd make the world better. And the results never held up and we never quite noticed. Then during the Trump years, the tech lash years, you started getting critical journalism about them, even though they and their platforms kept making more money. And then during the pandemic is when they just made ridiculous money. And like Elon Musk was like, I think he had maybe $12 billion at the start of the pandemic. A year later, he had over $100 billion, which is just too much money. Now he has $300 billion. That kind of money lets him buy Twitter. And even if it falls apart, not even notice it, because he went from, what, if he went from $330 to $290 billion, that's not enough to actually affect you at all. There's sort of a gravitational force to that much money, which bends all of society to your whims. So during the Biden years, in the United States, at least, I mean, in Europe, we've had a real regulatory system for a while now. The EU has taken this stuff seriously. But just in the past 4 years, the Biden administration said, you know, we actually need to treat these trillion-dollar tech firms like trillion-dollar companies and hold them responsible for their actions and their violations. And the tech barons hated that, which is what kind of curdled their optimism and led them to embrace Donald Trump. Now, not all of Silicon Valley likes Donald Trump. There are plenty of liberal engineers working at Google and Meta and Amazon. But the heads of these companies, particularly the venture capitalists and Elon Musk, looked around and said, you know, we're happy to talk about multiculturalism, but what we really value is never facing any taxes and never facing any regulations. And if the Democrats are going to try to regulate us, if they're going to apply antitrust to companies that are monopolies, then we're going to actively support with hundreds of millions of dollars the other side that says, we won't tax, we won't regulate, you guys can do whatever you want, because we are just the party fundamentally of billionaires. So that's the story, is basically Silicon Valley's ambitions were not inherently democratic, but they also weren't inherently fascist. But as their ambitions grew and they got all the money and power, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And as they got more and more power, they then chafed against anybody who said that there should be limits on that power, and that turned them against democracy.
And with the advent of artificial intelligence coming up now, do you think this will add up to the problems, or do you think there will be a big effect as well on how the political landscape online will change? Or isn't it such a central part of this story, according to you?
The near future of AI is going to be a mess. It's going to be terrible. And the basic thing I can tell you, so I wrote a piece for The Atlantic back in December 2022, I guess, 2 years ago. And this was not long after ChatGPT had come out. And the basic argument that I was making then, which I think has proved essentially correct, is that the trajectory of any new technology bends towards money. And we don't really know the future of generative AI until we know the business models of generative AI, which meant what I've spent the past 2 years arguing, that if we want to influence this new technology in a positive direction, the way you do that isn't regulating the foundation models. You need to regulate the business models. So in Europe, we do have AI regulations coming down the pike, and hopefully those will be strong ones. They look pretty strong now. At the state level in the United States, we have a few states that have tried to take this seriously. But the challenge that the Biden administration was haltingly living up to, like they were doing good things, but it was taking a long time to get there. But the challenge for them was to try to influence the direction that AI develops in by setting rules and frameworks that encourage companies to grow in pro-social directions. And Elon Musk hated that. The venture capitalists hated that. Sam Altman talked nice until he saw the regulations and then got mad about that. What we can expect now in the United States is an AI industry that faces no regulations and therefore chases the cheapest and worst types of money. That's going to lead to an era of fraud and corruption, even when the AI itself doesn't necessarily work all that well. Like they're already, some of these companies have already offered products that if you give it 10 to 15 seconds of a sound file, can then create a pretty compelling duplicate of that voice, which means that like an AI could listen to this podcast and then create a model of all three of our voices. That is like the one obvious use case for that is ransom.
It's fraud.
Like that is great for fraud. And every other use case for that basically doesn't exist. Like, I guess maybe Hollywood could use that to dupe some actors' voices, except they actually have a labor contract that says you're not allowed to do that. But like, you could imagine some other uses, maybe even possibly pro-social uses. But in terms of uses that have money behind them, it's all fraud, right? And the way that you stop that is by having governments that say, hey, if you produce these things that are mostly for fraud, you're going to face a lot of fines. It's either illegal or the fines are so punishing that you can't do it. Now in the United States, we will not have that because the people building those technologies now get to decide what parts of the government they want to exist. So I don't expect AI is going to have a big effect on legitimate campaigning because like it didn't matter this election cycle because it doesn't work that well. I don't expect it's going to work very well 2 or 4 years from now. we're going to be dealing with the aftershocks of it, because we're headed to a new age of fraud, and that's going to be weighing the entire economy down. If people can't trust anything they see or hear because they're just swamped with fraud all the goddamn time, yeah, that'll make campaigning more difficult, but it's not good for anybody except for the people in power, I guess.
I think that's really interesting. I think I heard it on Ezra Klein's show that they had this thesis that AI would be used in the political space basically to create masses of disinformation that then kind of look like normal information and will just be really, really difficult for people to distinguish what's a real piece of information and what's kind of AI generated bullshit. And I think that's really, really interesting and worrying if there's no regulation around it. And I guess it's a really good business model. I haven't thought of it this way, kind of from the business perspective, but I guess it's a really, it could be a really lucrative thing for people to create.
Yeah. I mean, the spinning up disinformation for cheaper, we can definitely see. How much money there is in disinformation, it's actually like, it kind of depends. Like governments mm-hmm. can fund that, and companies that want to fund disinformation against their opponents or online mm-hmm. attacks on them, you can see a bit of that. But what you're basically doing there is just taking the PR industry and scooping the money out of it. That's like a medium-sized pot of money, I would say. There have been, my guess is that Ezra Klein was referring to this one study that showed in a lab setting, people found the AI scripts to be more compelling than expert generated scripts. We actually need to see, I'm not entirely sure how much that'll hold up in the real world, because the experts that were generating that weren't necessarily actually the best in the field. It was like academics were putting together and being like, hey, this is what we do. Like, okay, but are you guys actually good at it? So I don't know how well that'll hold up. But the other thing to keep in mind is, like, we like to tell ourselves that democracy requires a well-informed electorate. And that's led people to look at misinformation and say, oh, well, if it undermines information, you can't have democracy. That is actually, I did some writing about this a few years ago, but like that's actually, as a practical matter, untrue. We have never had an electorate that's lived up to our ideals of an informed electorate. What we have long had are political elites who behaved as though they had a well-informed public. And that then moderates their behavior. If they believe that the public is watching and paying attention, then they behave better than if they think the world is full of misinformation, I can just be corrupt and nothing will matter. It's kind of a downstream consequence, what we call the liar's dividend. But as our elites come to believe that we're swimming in misinformation, no one's going to know what I'm doing anyway, so I should just take the money and grab the power. There's nothing holding me accountable. Like, that's a load-bearing myth within American democracy, or within electoral democracy. And I do see, even if the waves of online misinformation don't become more effective, because I'm not sure if the AI will be more effective at it, but if our elites come to believe that it's all misinformation and therefore nobody's holding me accountable, that ends up signaling the end of electoral democracy. So I think we need to be real worried about that. We need better and better behaved elites, basically.
I know that, like, also in political communication, emotions are more important than information. I know that for me personally, I find it really, really hard to connect to that somehow, because I think I'm just really information oriented as a person.
You do have an intellectual podcast. That probably makes you a little different than the average voter. Right?
True. So, but when we look at these platforms again, there have been this various times where people try to establish more like left-wing alternatives. We have seen that with... There was Mastodon. Now in Germany, there are a lot of people going to Blue Sky right now. Why do you think it's so difficult to build new left-wing platforms? And why is it so difficult to establish an alternative that might actually be working better for the people?
So let me modify that question a little bit, because at least in the United States, Blue Sky has won. Like, Blue Sky is the alternative. They have succeeded. I had an unnaturally large Twitter following, like so large that when Elon took over, I thought I would never be able to leave the platform. I was briefly Twitter famous in 2019 when I got into a fight with a New York Times columnist, and then the entire internet took my side. And that left me with just I didn't think I would ever have that kind of following. I now have a larger following on Blue Sky than I ever had on Twitter, even without a New York Times columnist calling my provost after I called him a bedbug. So, like, Blue Sky has won. It is generating more traffic for news organizations than Twitter does now. And you are right that it is incredibly hard to bridge that gap and build an alternative. So to me, the fascinating thing is that despite it being so hard for reasons that I can explain, it's actually worked. A basic reason that it's so hard is network effects and habits, right? So people spent 17 years building networks on Twitter. And that included both who is following me, but also who do I follow? They had curated lists of people who they followed. And all of those people are there. So there's a natural tendency for any social network to concentrate down to just one platform so everyone can be on the same platform. The thing to think around for listeners who are old enough to remember it is the mid-aughts when there were dozens of social networks. Like in the United States, first there was Friendster, then there was MySpace and Friendster, then there's MySpace and Facebook and like a dozen others. And I had accounts on like five of those networks, but I had to kind of circle through them or cycle through them to sort of figure out where are the people that I'm actually connected to spending their time. And then Facebook opened up its API and had a bunch of developers create games, which meant everybody with accounts on all those platforms spent all their time on Facebook because there's more to do there. And that gave them that network concentration, those eyeballs, that time on site that allowed them to dominate and monopolize. The reason why it's unsurprising that we've had trouble building left-wing alternatives, and the right has tried for years to build alternatives too, and they suck at it. Like Gab was a disaster. Truth Social was a disaster. The right spent years saying, we're getting kicked off of Twitter for being white nationalists. We need our own Twitter. And it never goes anywhere because there's locked-in network effects. You want to be well-racist. The fact of blue sky working is fascinating for that reason. Like it should not work on paper. The basic reason that it works is that Elon Musk is a world historic, terrible businessman. Like that guy sucks so bad that he was able to ruin a platform with 17 years of advantage. Now, the details there are, I think, a little more fascinating, or like they just augment that, but they're fascinating. That unlike the other Twitter alternatives, Blue Sky, which was spun off from Twitter, like it was started actually during Jack Dorsey's time and spun off as a separate company before it was bought by Elon Musk. And the idea was to do Twitter, but as a protocol instead of a company. But when they started up, the thing they did is during their closed beta, they invited a bunch of Twitter super users and said, hey, like you are masters of this form. You are addicts to this type of site. You are people who really like writing short form text, even a time when most people are on TikTok watching videos. Do you want to come over to a version of this that has fewer people, but also no death threats? And all those people, particularly, and it was populated at first by like trans shit posters. And they were like, yep, I would be happy to leave this, do the same thing that I like doing, but not have anyone threatening my life. And since it was invitation-based, they had about a year where they were growing the user base, where it was essentially a party where the people who are most addicted to Twitter and made the network worthwhile kept inviting their friends. And meanwhile, Elon Musk kept introducing terrible modifications to Twitter that led more people to say, I got to get the hell out of here. Mm-hmm. So the thing that stands out to me is because Mastodon is also protocol-based and they had a head start. But what Blue Sky did is they decided that they were going to take the culture and community very seriously and start by building a user base that liked Twitter and essentially made Twitter the user experience that people wanted. They hit that critical mass, they opened up, and then they kept capitalizing on Elon Musk's mistakes. Threads is still much larger than Blue Sky, and they had a large advantage for a long time. But now Blue Sky has more like daily users than even Threads. Like Threads has a larger user count, but people don't log in. And that's because Threads, being a Mark Zuckerberg production, decided to go very heavy on the algorithm and be almost impossible to read the people who you actually want to read. Like every time I go to Threads, I'm just lost on what's going on. And Blue Sky said, okay, the basic Twitter user experience is a reverse chronological feed of the people that you follow. We're just going to do that. We're going to invite the people who like that experience. They're going to populate the site and sort of give you the Twitter that you liked from 10 years ago. And then as Elon Musk keeps on screwing things up and people want to flee, they're going to flee to us. Like theoretically, like if you'd talked to me about this 3 years ago, I would have told you that it is functionally impossible for a social network to displace Twitter by offering just the things that Twitter already offers. That should not be possible. And the only explanation is that Elon Musk has so ruined Twitter because he is such a fucking idiot that Blue Sky has been able to succeed. I mean, if you look at the boost in user numbers, it's not just post-election, but every spike in user numbers before that was driven by Elon Musk announcing another change to the platform that made the platform worse. And people said, oh shit, where do I go? And they go to the thing that was spun off by Twitter that looks a lot like Twitter, but didn't have as many people. You know, now it's got like 25 or so million people, keeps on growing. It doesn't have quite the numbers of Twitter, but it has the usage of Twitter. And it doesn't have a bunch of bots or white nationalists offering you death threats all the time. It's fantastic. And its success, like it's not so unsurprising that it's hard for that to succeed. It should be impossible. It is only possible because of the sort of the most powerful, like one of the most powerful sort of propulsive negative forces in the world is Elon Musk's fucking personality. That guy.
So we've been talking a lot about the US elections, but we have this upcoming election in Germany too. And in the end of our podcast, we always ask our guest, what's to be done? So in this case, I would like to ask you, What can we in Germany maybe learn now from the US election? Looking forward to ours.
So again, since I specialize in US elections and you have a different electoral system and the thing I always try to remind international audiences when I talk about US elections is that our elections are ridiculous. They last a year and a half. They're multi-billion dollar affairs. Every other democracy has a structurally better electoral system than us. So I'm reticent to give advice because I feel like the system that I study is just so unique and embarrassing. But the main thing I would note is, like I mentioned this earlier in the podcast, but I think return to organizing basics and take the threat really seriously. Right? Like we are living in a time where the US electorate, having experienced Donald Trump and then rejected Donald Trump, said, we are so at odds with the status quo that we're going to go back to that. And if we can go back to that, then other countries can also embrace right-wing trends where a year or two ago, you would have thought we know better. So you know, that's not advice of like, here's how you win, because I don't know how to win. My country just lost. And I think the loss is going to be with us for generations. But all that I come back to is the fundamentals of organizing or how we build power. And this is a time to build power and take seriously the challenges in front of us. So I imagine all your listeners, particularly if they've listened to a podcast, me talking for this long with you, I imagine they all take it seriously, but I want to encourage them like that is the right approach. And protect the vulnerable, organize, build community. That's what we do.
Thank you so much. We will definitely take it with us and try our best to organize.
Thanks so much for taking the time, Dave. Very much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Wir sitzen jetzt hier nochmal zusammen, um die losen Enden ein bisschen einzusammeln und vielleicht auch um die wichtigsten Punkte nochmal zusammenzufassen nach dem Gespräch. Valentin, was bleibt dir denn als erstes noch im Kopf?
Ja, ich glaube, eine Frage, mit der ich in das Gespräch reingegangen bin, war auf jeden Fall, was passiert, wenn jetzt die zweite Amtszeit von Donald Trump bevorsteht? Welche Szenarien gibt es da? Und ich fand, da hat Dave auf jeden Fall ganz gute Szenarien aufgemacht, die es irgendwie so ein bisschen konkreter werden lassen, was passieren könnte. Nämlich auf der einen Seite, dass der Faschismus kommt. Das hört man ja immer mal wieder in letzter Zeit, dass das auf jeden Fall etwas ist, wo viele Leute wirklich Angst vor haben in den USA, dass es in die Richtung gehen könnte. Und auf der anderen Seite, dass es aber schon auch noch die Möglichkeit gibt, dass dieses Trump-Kabinett, was der jetzt aufstellt, man hat ja in den letzten Wochen immer wieder die Picks gehört, welche Namen da jetzt gerade im Topf sind, wer gehandelt wird, welche Skandale es um diese ganzen Leute gibt, dass das tatsächlich auch dazu führen könnte, dass es ein relativ dysfunktionales Kabinett geben könnte. Und falls das der Fall ist und dieses Szenario zutrifft, eben auch die Möglichkeiten für progressive Einflussnahmen viel größer sind. Zum Beispiel, wenn man eben ganz gezielt diese Konfliktlinien innerhalb der Trump-Regierung dann versucht zu eskalieren. Und da war, fand ich, auch schon so ein erstes wichtiges Campaigning-Learning für mich dabei, nämlich als CampaignerInnen sind ja die Konflikte auf der gegnerischen Seite immer was, was wir erstmal prinzipiell gut finden und wo wir versuchen mitzuarbeiten. So jetzt auch da in den USA. Das fand ich ganz interessant.
Mhm. Ja, total. Das fand ich auch einen interessanten Punkt. Auch, dass er ganz am Anfang erstmal noch gesagt hat, eine zweite Trump-Präsidentschaft wird grundsätzlich erstmal sehr anders aussehen als die erste Präsidentschaft und auch schon auch dieses Gefühl nochmal beschrieben hat, mit dem Leute gerade da unterwegs sind. Also, dass die Antwort 2016 war Widerstand und jetzt eigentlich eher so eine Form von Depression oder wie hat er es genannt? Ich glaube, er hat gesagt, es gibt entweder die Leute, die in Denial sind, also die, die sich eigentlich der Realität verweigern, dass sie gerade sehr schlecht ist, und die, die in Depression und Despair sind, also die eher auf der Seite von Traurigkeit und Verzweiflung sich gerade befinden, und dass beide Reaktionen aber eigentlich nicht hilfreich sind, sondern dass man jetzt erstmal abwarten muss, was passiert. Und ein Punkt, den er dann noch gemacht hat zu diesen beiden Szenarien, die du gerade genannt hast, den ich richtig interessant fand, war, dass die Frage auch einfach ist, was für Protestrepertoires eine Gesellschaft hat. Und dass, wenn das erste Szenario eintritt, der Faschismus, dass es dann irgendwie schlecht aussieht, weil die US-Gesellschaft damit einfach seit 200 Jahren keine Erfahrung mehr gemacht hat. Mhm. Und die ganzen Protestrepertoires, die gut bekannt sind und die Leute kennen und können, dass die halt vor allem in dem ersten Szenario funktionieren können, wo es schon auch eine Regierung gibt, die sich an gewisse Regeln hält und auf so ein gewisses Feedback der Bevölkerung irgendwie reagiert oder angewiesen ist.
Ja, das fand ich auch einen sehr interessanten Punkt mit den Protestrepertoires, weil die sind ja auch, ich meine, das ist ja ein bisschen die zugrunde liegende Annahme bei seinem Argument, dass die eben auch sehr hartnäckig sind. Also was wir in der Bewegungspolitik tun, ist nicht einfach rein instrumentell. Wir sind in einer Situation, die bestimmte Reaktionen dann rational scheinen lässt. Wenn das Szenario eintritt, dann werden alle das und das machen, weil es die einzig logische Antwort ist darauf. Ja. Sondern dass es eher eben so tradiert ist. Also wir wählen immer wieder aus den Formen, die uns bereits bekannt sind. Und es ist auch gar nicht so leicht, da zu wechseln. Mhm. So. Und das ist natürlich jetzt soziologisch interessant, im Hinblick auf die USA natürlich total beunruhigend.
Das stimmt. Obwohl auch da habe ich mich zum Beispiel gefragt, wie viel Gesellschaften trotzdem auch von anderen Gesellschaften lernen können. Also David Karp hat ja selber jetzt das Beispiel genannt aus Südkorea, wo die Gesellschaft sich gerade dagegen gewehrt hat, dass der Präsident einfach so die Macht übernimmt. Oder es gibt auch von Timothy Snyder, einem berühmten Historiker in den USA, Bücher, wo er lange über den Faschismus und die Entstehung des Faschismus in Europa in den 30er Jahren geforscht hat und daraus auch schon vor der letzten Präsidentschaft von Donald Trump so 20 Lehren gezogen hat. Genau, und das ist, glaube ich, die Frage, wie gut man das dann einsetzen kann, wenn es noch nicht habituell verankert ist, sage ich jetzt mal. Also wenn die Leute die Formen noch nicht kennen und noch nie vorher selber ausprobiert haben.
Ja, weil ich meine, es ist auch so ein bisschen diese Frage, also die Formen von politischer Beteiligung, die eben sehr stark verankert sind in der Gesellschaft, das sind ja dann gleichzeitig auch die, die als legitim gelten, wohingegen andere als illegitim angesehen werden. Das sieht man zum Beispiel auch, wenn man sich jetzt zum Beispiel die Protestkultur in Deutschland und in Frankreich im Vergleich anguckt, dann sieht man, dass die Franzosen es viel normaler finden, wenn Mülltonnen brennen, als die Deutschen. Und das liegt nicht an den Mülltonnen, sondern es liegt eben natürlich daran, dass die Leute einfach ein anderes Wertesystem haben und auch die Folie von legitimem Protest dort eine andere ist als hier. Ne?
Und dass die Deutschen es, glaube ich, sehr illegitim finden, ihren gerade getrennten Müll zu verbrennen. Anyway, next point. Was hast du denn noch mitgenommen, Valentin?
Ja, wir haben ja dann auch noch mal ein bisschen mehr über so das ganze Thema Wahlen und Kampagnen gesprochen. Einerseits noch mal in der Rückschau über die Wahl in den USA, aber dann auch eben über die Frage, was können wir daraus lernen? Was sind irgendwie Sachen, die wir mitnehmen können, wenn es jetzt darum geht, dass in Deutschland bald gewählt wird? Und genau, ich glaube, da fand ich auch einige Punkte spannend. Einerseits natürlich so dieses, okay, das war jetzt eine Wahl post-Covid, post-Inflation und Regierungen auf der ganzen Welt werden jetzt praktisch abgestraft danach, weil die Leute einfach sagen, uns geht's schlechter. Das hatte ich jetzt auch schon ein paar Mal gelesen, war für mich jetzt nicht ganz neu, aber finde ich einen ganz wichtigen Punkt, dass man das nochmal so als ein Takeaway mitnimmt, weil eben in Deutschland ja jetzt in einem ähnlichen Szenario sind, wo die progressiven Kräfte, also auch wenn wir oft unzufrieden mit ihnen sind, die Grünen und SPD halt in der Regierung waren, in der Zeit viel Scheiße passiert ist. Und auch wenn sie als Krisenmanager einen gar nicht so schlechten Job zum Teil gemacht haben, die Leute trotzdem unzufrieden sind. Und deswegen, man sieht es in den Umfragen, die Stimmung im Land auch sehr stark gekippt ist. Da gibt es auf jeden Fall eine große Ähnlichkeit hier in Deutschland, wo wir was draus lernen können. Ich fand aber am spannendsten, ehrlich gesagt, den Punkt, als David nochmal so ein bisschen die gängigen Erklärungen für diese Wahlniederlage von Harris und Tim Walz durchgegangen ist und nochmal erklärt hat, warum er das alles nicht besonders überzeugend fand.
Ja, das fand ich auch interessant, vor allem, dass er gesagt hat, dass er es als unseriös findet. Und das kann ich auf jeden Fall gut nachvollziehen auch, dass das so ein klares Ergebnis war, was einfach mit gesellschaftlichen Trends und einer gesellschaftlichen Lebensrealität zu tun hat, dass man halt nicht sagen kann, das lag an dieser einen Gruppe. Und das heißt, es lag weder daran, dass die Democrats zu woke oder zu wenig woke waren oder daran, dass die Working Class ignoriert wurde oder nicht. Da hat er ja ziemlich klar gesagt, das könnten alles Erklärungen für kleine Veränderungen sein. Aber so groß wie die Veränderungen waren, muss man einfach sehen, dass es einen Trend gab, der lagerübergreifend gewirkt hat. Und das sind halt, können eigentlich nur so Sachen sein wie Inflation oder Covid.
Ja, da fand ich zum Beispiel zu diesem Punkt, es gibt ja jetzt gerade in der Linken viele Leute, die sagen, ja, Bernie Sanders hätte sicher gewonnen, dass Dave da gesagt hat, dass man das eigentlich, diese Erklärung vor allem verstehen muss als einen Versuch, nach dieser Niederlage jetzt das politische Momentum zu nutzen, um den eigenen Einfluss innerhalb der Demokratischen Partei auszuweiten, dass Dave das ja auch gut findet, weil er Bernie Sanders auch gut findet und auch will, dass dieses linke Lager innerhalb der Demokraten stärker an Einfluss gewinnt. Ich denke, das geht uns allen so. Aber eben trotzdem den Abstrich zu machen und zu sagen, so, das ist jetzt nicht die Analyse, die uns jetzt zeigt, woran es gelegen hat.
Ja, total. Ich glaube, ein weiterer Punkt, den ich irgendwie nochmal interessant fand, jetzt auch mit Blick auf die Bundestagswahl, ist die Analyse, die er nochmal gemacht hat dazu, wie einfach Progressive oder Linke auf einem unequal playing field, also auf sozusagen einer ungleichen Basis stehen, was Wahlkämpfe angeht im Vergleich zu Rechten und Rechtspopulisten. Nämlich darin, dass wir irgendwie als Progressive immer am Ende noch versuchen, was zu verteidigen, was einfach insgesamt sehr komplex ist. Selbst wenn wir auch grundlegende Veränderungen an Regierung wollen oder am Staat wollen oder so, dann wollen wir trotzdem einen Staat mit einer starken Infrastruktur, mit vielen Absicherungen, in denen an ganz vielen Orten Sachen demokratisch entschieden werden und Menschen gemeinsam mit demokratischen Prozessen sind. Und das heißt aber natürlich, dass es insgesamt ein sehr komplexes System ist, was man da am Ende verteidigt und dass es immer schwieriger ist, das zu kommunizieren und vor allem am Ende auch in jetzt so Wahlkämpfen wie in den USA, wo es nur zwei Parteien gibt, zu kommunizieren. Man ist auf der Seite der Demokraten, die grundsätzlich den Staat irgendwie schützen wollen oder die grundsätzlich den Staat behalten wollen, dass das immer schwieriger ist, das zu kommunizieren, als zu sagen, die bösen Eliten nehmen uns alles weg, es liegt am Deep State und wir müssen sie einfach nur alle loswerden, alle unsere Probleme sind gelöst. Und das fand ich irgendwie nochmal interessant, weil ich glaube, dass es schon ein ähnliches Problem zunehmend auf jeden Fall auch in Deutschland gibt, jetzt insbesondere gegenüber der AfD und dem BSW, die ja auch sehr stark die korrupten Elitendiskurs fahren, wo es eben sehr schwierig ist, irgendwie noch dagegen zu argumentieren, dass man konkrete Verbesserungen in diesem System will oder das System an bestimmten Stellschrauben verändern, damit es sich auch grundsätzlich ändert, aber wo man immer in einer komplexeren Argumentation am Ende ist, irgendwie als dieser reine populistische Diskurs.
Ja, das fand ich auf jeden Fall auch einen interessanten Punkt zum Thema Kommunikation und Messaging. Eine Frage vielleicht noch an dich, Inken. Ich meine, es gibt ja immer wieder Diskussion linker Populismus. Da versucht man ja, das so ein bisschen zu durchstoßen und nicht zu sagen, es ist alles in Wirklichkeit furchtbar kompliziert und komplex und wir müssen alles ganz viel erklären und dann hoffen wir, dass die Leute uns trotzdem noch gut finden. Wie würdest du das jetzt miteinander verbinden? Also
David Kaff meinte ja auch, und das stimmt, glaube ich, dass wir ja auch Versionen von diesen Narrativen haben. Also wir haben ja auch Versionen, in denen wir sagen, es sind die reichen Millionäre und Milliardäre, die nicht genug besteuert werden. Wenn wir sie gerecht besteuern, dann haben wir genug Geld für uns alle zusammen, für die Sachen, die wir machen wollen. Ich glaube, dass leider es trotzdem immer schwieriger ist, Demokratisierung und Vergesellschaftung zu kommunizieren, als jeder macht für sich allein. Einfach weil die grundsätzliche Erfahrung der Menschen im Neoliberalismus ist, jeder macht für sich allein und es dann natürlich viel leichter ist, anzuknüpfen und den Leuten die Geschichte zu erzählen, ja, jeder macht für sich allein und daran, dass du es alleine gerade nicht schaffst, ist übrigens nur der Staat und der Deep State und dass es so viel davon gibt, schuld. Und ich glaube, unter der Prämisse ist es einfach schwieriger zu sagen, wenn wir es dann alle gemeinsam machen, dann wird es schon klappen, weil das setzt total viel Vertrauen darauf voraus, dass am Ende alle auch wirklich mitmachen und dass alle sich an die gemeinsamen Regeln halten. Und das ist, glaube ich, einfach viel schwieriger zu vermitteln.
Wobei jetzt bei dem Punkt, du hast jetzt gerade von Vergesellschaftung gesprochen, da finde ich zum Beispiel ganz interessant, also das würde ich niemandem empfehlen, das zu kommunizieren als Teil der Botschaft, weil das ja einfach nur ein Prozess ist. Und da haben wir ja von Anat gelernt, dass man sich eher auf das Ergebnis konzentrieren soll, als auf den Prozess oder die Instrumente dahin. Also deswegen sollten wir auch nicht sagen, tax the rich, sondern mehr darüber sprechen, was wir mit dem Geld machen könnten, wenn Reiche gerecht besteuert werden würden, was dann eher so ein nachgeschobener Weg zu mehr öffentlichem Geld ist und nicht schon unsere politische Utopie. Übersetzt auf das Feld von Vergesellschaftung wäre es eben mehr Selbstbestimmung, eine andere Form von Gestaltungsmöglichkeiten im öffentlichen Raum, im Verkehr und so weiter, also konkrete Sachen, die man da anders machen will. Und dann schlägt man das halt vor als den Prozess dahin, der aber dann praktisch nicht das Element der Botschaft ist, die die Leute mobilisiert, oder?
Das stimmt. Aus der Komplexitätsnummer kommst du, glaube ich, trotzdem nicht raus, weil auch, deswegen habe ich dieses Beispiel der Demokratisierung auch genannt, dass wenn man demokratisieren will und das eins der Ziele ist, dass man auf einer Werteebene verfolgt, dann wird es immer noch ziemlich viele Leute geben, die darauf keinen Bock haben. Das, glaube ich, als erstes. Als zweites scheint es einfach immer noch, glaube ich, mit der erlebten Realität von Menschen gibt es da einen ganz schönen Clash, weil die Leute sich vor allem erstmal denken, ich habe keine Zeit dafür. Oder mit meinem Nachbarn habe ich da auch keinen Bock drauf. Und dass da einfach so viele Veränderungen gleichzeitig notwendig sind, dass es ganz schön kompliziert ist. Noch ein letzter Punkt dazu. Ich glaube, was außerdem schwierig ist, was für die USA gilt, aber für Deutschland auch, ist, dass wir zwar ein stärker gebrochenes parlamentarisches System haben, wo man stärker mit der eigenen Zielgruppe sprechen kann, dass es aber trotzdem immer noch auch so ist, dass wir auf der liberalen und linken Seite einfach breitere Koalitionen haben aus einem Spektrum von Leuten, die eigentlich den Staat sehr grundlegend verändern wollen und den Leuten, die ihn im Wesentlichen so behalten wollen, wie er jetzt ist, aber kleine Sachen verändern wollen, viel ein paar Reformen vielleicht machen wollen. Und man mit denen gemeinsam sprechen muss und es total schwierig ist, die gemeinsam zu adressieren. Und wenn man dazu linkspopulistisch wird, man den Teil der linken Wähler in Koalition verliert, den man auch braucht, um zu gewinnen.
Ich finde, ein weiterer Aspekt bei dieser Frage nach dem ungleichen Terrain für Rechte und Linke Botschaften ist tatsächlich auch, dass linke Botschaften immer Veränderungsbotschaften sind. Also man sagt, es könnte alles besser sein, wenn ihr das und das macht. Und dann müssen die Leute dir immer noch glauben, dass es, wenn es anders wäre, tatsächlich auch besser wäre und dass es nicht vielleicht gar nicht funktioniert in Wirklichkeit, was man vorschlägt oder gar nicht realistisch ist, dass man es wirklich umsetzen kann oder diese ganzen Sachen. Und Rechte verändern ja auch wahnsinnig viel. Also sieht man jetzt praktisch ja gerade auch in den USA bei dieser Koalition aus Elon Musk und Donald Trump, die ja wirklich disruptiv jetzt praktisch den Staat erschüttern. Aber die verkaufen das immer in einer Botschaft, die letztendlich eher rückwärtsgewandt ist und die einem deswegen viel mehr das Gefühl gibt, dass sich die Sachen schon mal bewährt hätten. Die sagen ja, die haben ja keine Utopie, sondern eher so eine Retropie, wo sie sagen, eben bei Make America Great Again, es war schon alles mal gut und das Altbewährte, das gab es schon alles, das wollen wir wieder machen.
Ja.
Und das ist irgendwie, löst was ganz anderes aus als dieses progressiv in die Zukunft gerichtete, ne?
Ja, das erinnert mich auch daran, dass ich mal bei Fokusgruppen dabei war. Also bei, da wählt man so Leute aus dem gesellschaftlichen Spektrum aus, die werden dann von ModeratorInnen verschiedene Fragen gestellt und man erfährt so einiges über deren gesellschaftliche Sicht und kann halt auch Botschaften so testen und gucken, wie die Menschen darauf reagieren. Und dass da eine Kommunikationsempfehlung am Ende auch war, dass man nicht sagen soll, wie man möchte, dass Deutschland sich verändert, sondern dass im Grunde das Narrativ, Deutschland soll wieder besser werden, am Ende am besten funktioniert hat. Selbst wenn man Sachen auch macht, die es vielleicht noch gar nicht gab, aber dass Leute vor allem dieses Gefühl haben wollen, dass es nichts ganz grundlegend Neues ist, sondern dass man den Status quo noch ein bisschen verbessert, dass es sich in Anführungsstrichen wieder ein bisschen besser anfühlt. Und das hängt, glaube ich, auch damit zusammen, dass viele Leute sich einfach irgendwann in der Vergangenheit in ihrem Leben schon mal besser gefühlt haben und da dann immer dran denken und immer wieder hin zurück wollen. Ja.
Vielleicht wirklich letzter Punkt dazu. Ist irgendwie gerade ein spannendes Gespräch. Deswegen finde ich es auch cool, dass wir da irgendwie jetzt vielleicht kurz bei dem Punkt verweilen. Aber genau, ich finde, bei dieser ganzen Messaging- und Framing-Diskussion muss man sich am Ende dann auch immer wieder dran erinnern, dass selbst wenn es dieses ungleiche Terrain gibt und man versucht natürlich das Beste daraus zu machen, dass man einen Nachteil hat gegenüber den Rechten, man dann nicht letztendlich versucht, linke Botschaften auch nur noch zu verpacken in so eine Art Retropia, sondern man kann halt auch gesellschaftliche Veränderungen am Ende nur mit einem gesellschaftlichen Mandat dann auch machen, was darauf fußt, dass man den Leuten eben auch gewisse Sachen irgendwie erfolgreich verkauft, in Anführungsstrichen. Das fand ich noch einen interessanten Punkt.
Ja, das finde ich auch einen guten Punkt. Und ich fand insgesamt aber auch nochmal bei allem diesem im Blick zu behalten, dass David ja auch sehr klar gesagt hat, das schlägt jetzt vielleicht die Brücke nochmal zurück zu den Gründen auch des Wahlverlusts, dass man am Ende mit Messaging, also mit guten Botschaften und guten Narrativen, Politik wirklich nur an den Rändern verändern kann, also wirklich nur kleine Prozentsätze verändern kann. Wenn der gesellschaftliche Wind einfach grundsätzlich gegen einen steht, dann schafft man es damit trotzdem einfach nicht.
Das ist auch ein guter Reality-Check für alle Leute, die an Kampagnen arbeiten, dass man sich da auch nicht zu sehr überschätzt, sondern dass man eben weiß, okay, unsere Rolle ist hier, das Ganze nochmal ein bisschen aufzupolieren und die grundsätzlichen Verhältnisse sind aber irgendwie auch, wie sie sind.
Ja, okay, letzter Punkt. Social Media und Politik. Da haben wir eigentlich noch ziemlich lange drüber gesprochen. Vielleicht werfen wir da jetzt einfach nochmal ein paar Schlaglichter darauf, was wir da noch so am meisten im Kopf haben.
Ja, also ich würde sagen, die Klammer zu dem Punkt ist für mich so ein bisschen, Social Media war mal ein sehr anderer Ort, als es heute ist.
Ja.
Und es war mal praktisch ein Ort, an dem sich Leute vernetzt haben, Gegenmacht aufbauen konnten und so weiter. Heute haben wir ungefähr 20 Jahre später super kommerzielle Plattformen, auf denen es oft für Progressive total schwer ist, durchzudringen. Das beste Beispiel, das hat David im Gespräch ja auch sehr stark gemacht, ist dafür natürlich Twitter. Aber es gilt in gewissen Maßen eben auch für andere Plattformen wie TikTok oder Instagram, dass entweder Politik insgesamt kaum mehr vorkommt oder eben rechte Akteure Vorteile haben. Genau, das wäre so für mich die Klammer eigentlich zu dem Punkt Social Media und Politik. Und dann vielleicht noch als so ein einzelnes Takeaway für mich, dass er gesagt hat, die Social Media Landschaft ist auch viel fragmentierter heute. Also sie zerfällt immer mehr in kleine Inseln.
Ja, was ich auch immer interessant finde an diesen Social-Media-Plattformen, die ja inzwischen fast alle großen Tech-Milliardären gehören, dass er da nochmal gesagt hat, die haben zum Teil mit ganz anderen Ambitionen gestartet, als sie jetzt in den Plattformen tatsächlich umsetzen, weil was man von so einem jungen Typ Silicon Valley vielleicht, da geht es vor allem tatsächlich um die vielleicht auch gesellschaftlichen Ambitionen oder so, die der hat, und es ist dann vielleicht so eine schillernde Figur. Und das, wenn man dann aber tatsächlich Besitzer so einer großen Tech-Plattform ist, dann geht es halt vor allem am Ende um die Zahlen und um die Nutzerzahlen und das, die Dividenden und Revenues, die da rauskommen. Und dass das einfach auch sehr stark verändert, wie diese Plattformen gestaltet werden am Ende oder auch, was die dann politisch gut finden, weil sie vielleicht am Anfang auch noch denken, dieses soll alles ein Ort von freiem Sprechen und freier Rede und demokratischem Diskurs sein und so. Und sich am Ende, wenn sie aber merken, dass die Regulierung gegen Fake News oder Hate Speech sie auf ihrer Plattform ganz schön viel Geld kosten, sie sich dann doch politisch nochmal ein bisschen fragen, wo sie eigentlich stehen, weil es einfach zu teuer für sie ist und dann halt Revenue aber am Ende wichtiger ist. Das fand ich nochmal einen interessanten Punkt und auch nochmal eine interessante Teilerklärung dafür, warum Social Media gerade da steht, auch wo es steht.
Mhm. Ja, und ich fand das auch einen interessanten Punkt jetzt im Hinblick auf KI, da hatten wir auch noch kurz drüber geredet, dass er eben gesagt hat, in welche Richtung sich KI am Ende entwickelt, wird dann davon abhängen, weniger von dem Code, also was ist da programmiert, was kann dieses spezifische technische Tool, als was ist das Businessmodell, mit dem es sich verbindet. Und solange man das Businessmodell nicht kennt, ist auch total schwer zu sagen, wie es sich politisch entwickelt. Das fand ich nochmal eine gute Schablone, auch um diese Verschiebung im Social-Media-Bereich, aber auch darüber hinaus irgendwie so zu erklären.
Mhm. Ja, total. Von daher, interessante Entwicklung in Deutschland, der Exit, mit dem jetzt viele Leute noch gerade große Accounts oder Menschen mit großen Accounts entschieden haben, von X ehemals Twitter zu gehen und stattdessen auf Blue Sky zu gehen. Genau, da haben wir drüber gesprochen. Das ist eine Plattform, die kennen bestimmt viele von euch inzwischen auch schon. Für die anderen, es ist so ähnlich wie Twitter früher war und zeigt im Grunde immer noch sehr stark oder jetzt wieder diese Kultur, die es früher auf Twitter gab, eher so Nischenexpertentum. Man guckt sich raus, wem man folgen möchte. Ich folge zum Beispiel jetzt da irgendwie wieder so eine Reihe von Leuten aus dem Energiebereich und Klimabereich irgendwie, wo man so ein bisschen spezialisierte Expertise und Wissen kriegt und aber vor allem einfach ein Diskurs irgendwie ist, der sich bildet. Und das ist wirklich jetzt ziemlich erstaunlich und spannend, auch was David erzählt hat, dass es überhaupt gelungen ist, Blue Sky so groß jetzt aufzuziehen.
Hm. Ja, ich weiß nicht wie, also in Deutschland muss man nochmal gucken. Ich habe da auch das Gefühl, es gab jetzt nochmal so einen großen Push mit dieser Exit-Aktion, also wo Leute kollektiv ihre Twitter-Konten gelöscht haben und zu Blue Sky gegangen sind. Ich glaube, ganz so erfolgreich wie in den USA ist es in Deutschland noch nicht, kann es aber natürlich werden und hängt natürlich auch von uns allen ab, wie wir uns entscheiden.
So ist das.
Ja, das war jetzt eine lange Nachbesprechung. Wir haben sie ein bisschen länger gemacht, weil wir das Gefühl hatten, bei englischen Folgen ist es manchmal hilfreich, die Punkte nochmal ein bisschen ausführlicher nachzubesprechen. Nicht alle Leute sprechen gut Englisch und da kann es ja hilfreich sein, sich das Ganze dann nochmal ein bisschen kondensiert zusammenfassen zu lassen. Wir hoffen, dass es interessant für euch war und freuen uns, wenn ihr wieder einschaltet, wenn es in einem Monat wieder heißt.
Was tun?
Ciao.
Tschüss.
Das war der Was-Tun-Podcast. Konzept und Redaktion Inken Beermann und Valentin Isen. Schnitt Julian Schlumberger. Und die Musik kommt von Richard Waterman.